From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. On Friday in Davos, Russia announced that it would be extending asylum to master leaker Edward Snowden. On Thursday, the Privacy and Civil Liberties Oversight Board, an independent federal watchdog, released a thick report deeming the NSA's bulk collection of phone records revealed by Snowden illegal and calling for it to stop. Meanwhile, a new Pew Research Center poll found Americans taking an increasingly dim view of those NSA surveillance programs since the big reveals about them leaked last June. But how passionate are we? Pew found that 91% of us heard nothing or just a little about President Obama's recently announced changes in the programs, and roughly three-quarters of us believe that they won't matter anyway. But we do seem to have strong opinions about former NSA contractor Edward Snowden. Here's Representative Mike Rogers speaking to David Gregory on Sunday's Meet the Press.
This was a thief who we believe had some help, who stole information the vast majority had nothing to do with privacy. Our Army, Navy, Air Force, Marines have been incredibly harmed by the data that he has taken with him.
And we then Rogers took the gloves off.
I don't think it was a gee whiz luck event that he ended up in Moscow.
Now, Rogers' views cleave closely to that Pew poll that found your view of Snowden can be predicted in large part by your age. People over 50 are far more likely to think that Snowden harmed the public interest. The younger you are, the more you approve of what he did. However, Pew senior researcher Juliana Horowitz says that the generational split shrinks considerably when the issue of criminal charges comes up.
Among the 18 to 29-year-olds, 57% say that Snowden served the public interest with these leaks. 35% say he harmed the public interest. But they're split evenly. 42% say the government should pursue a criminal case, and 42% say it should not.
Among the 30 to 49-year-olds, nearly half of the respondents, 48%, think Snowden served the public interest. But even more than half, 56%, thinks that the government should pursue a criminal case against him.
You can dislike the NSA programs and also dislike Snowden, and you can think that Snowden served the public interest but still think that what he did was criminal. It's a more nuanced story than simply Snowden's a hero or not.
On Thursday, Attorney General Eric Holder told a University of Virginia audience that the government is open to talking to Snowden on the condition that he plead guilty to criminal charges.
The notion of clemency was not something that we were willing to consider. But as I said, were he to come back to the United States, enter a plea, we would engage with his lawyers.
And presumably that would be a guilty plea to something.
Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm.
That same day, Snowden was engaged in a live Twitter Q&A courtesy of the website freesnowden.com. He said that the law he's charged with breaking forbids a public interest defense, which means, quote, "There is no chance to have a fair trial and no way I can come home and make my case to a jury." Recently, the nation's most revered whistleblower, Daniel Ellsberg, called Snowden a hero. When the president spoke about the NSA programs last week, he said he wouldn't dwell on Snowden's actions or motivations. But
if any individual who objects to government policy can take it into their own hands to publicly disclose classified information, then we will not be able to keep our people safe or conduct foreign policy.
And certainly, not only did Snowden expose unconstitutional intrusions into the privacy of Americans, he also revealed our spying operations abroad, which presumably are what intelligence services the world over are created to do. Did he act to protect the rights of Americans or dismantle what he considers a surveillance state? Does it matter why he acted? Does it matter why journalist Glenn Greenwald brought Snowden's leaks to the world, or why WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange helped Snowden get to Russia? New Republic contributing editor Sean Wilentz has just written a cover story asking the question, would you feel differently about Snowden, Greenwald, and Assange if you knew what they really thought? Sean, welcome back to On the Media.
Great to be here.
So that was quite an in-depth piece, but before we get to it, I just want to disclose that in it, you cite a column by Slate writer Fred Kaplan, to whom I'm married. That said, some have described your piece as a smear job on Snowden, Greenwald, and Assange, but that's not how you see it. So why did you write it?
Well, I wrote it because I think the story was not being covered. This is a very polarized story. Distinctions like, is he a traitor or is he a hero? And that doesn't strike me as a very useful way to go about thinking about this story. You can be both. But the main problem was I didn't think that the story was being covered.
Although you took almost everything in your piece from previously published reports.
Well, exactly. But it's all scattered. And, you know, if you establish the chronology, you see things that look much more interesting. The first thing was the discrepancy between Snowden's narrative of how he came to be a secrecy activist and what, in fact, his writings actually showed. Some of his writings turned up on a site called Ars Technica. And his story, whereby he got very angry at the intelligence under Bush, and then Obama was coming in, and he thought Obama would change the intelligence policies, and he was very angry when that didn't happen. The chronology of his postings doesn't corroborate that.
So what story do his postings on Ars Technica tell?
Stuff that shows that he is very much against leakers. He would like to have them castrated, I'll put it that way.
He thought that leakers should be castrated when Bush was in office.
In 2009, just before Obama's being inaugurated. That's when that post dates from. So something he wrote does not match up with the story that we've got.
What about the Russian business? There's been some incredibly irresponsible speculation by congresspeople on our major Sunday bloviation shows.
Yeah. Well, look, accusing somebody of being a Russian spy and going in and doing what Snowden did without any evidence is terribly irresponsible. The question is, why does he go to Russia? He had talked about wanting to, you know, be in a country very, very nobly that, you know, was a free country so he could do his work. Russia is not exactly the place that you would have chosen off the top of the list. So how did he end up there? Then there's a backstory, which I discovered, about Assange's connections with the Putin regime. So the whole thing begins to take on a new light.
Assange did say that he was helping Snowden with his legal case, right?
Well, that's right. But more than that, in getting out of Hong Kong and over to Russia, Izvestia actually reported that Russian intelligence worked with WikiLeaks to make that possible.
You suggested that you can't really understand Snowden without understanding Assange, and that it was important to put the three of them into one piece. And why is that?
These are three very different men, very different temperaments, very different backgrounds, very different ideas, but they have some things in common. Many of their supporters believe that their object is to try and end these malefactors from ruining American democracy. But I think there's something deeper. I think there's a view of national security which is paranoid. And I try to show in the piece how that common thread shows up in their writings and what they've talked about and so forth. I do think that a lot of people on the left don't understand the libertarian background, especially of Ed Snowden. But this is information that was on the web. Anybody could have reported it. And it throws a different light on Edward Snowden than I think a lot of people on the left might imagine him to be.
It may, but why does it matter? The world is full of problematic people doing things that ultimately enhance the public good. An unsympathetic defendant in a court case could be a terrible poster child for a cause, but he could still help set precedents and establish excellent law.
I'm not trying to disgrace Edward Snowden. I'm just trying to say, who is Edward Snowden? It in no way diminishes the value and the importance of some of what has come out about the NSA, which is very disturbing. But that's part of the story. It's not the whole story. There are portraits that I'm drawing on the basis of what we know that show that Snowden in particular has a series of ideas which are very much a part of the libertarian right. Now, there are ideas that he had some years ago. We don't know how he's developed, except he did support Ron Paul in 2012 with a couple of contributions. That's where he seems to be coming from. With Greenwald, he's a complicated character, but he has views that, from what I've read, that are just at the point where the radical left and the radical right can meet. I don't think he's simply a libertarian. I think he's more complicated than that. But the libertarians will tell a young hippie or something, we should legalize marijuana. And then he'll tell a businessman, no more regulations. The point is to bring together the libertarian right and a section of the American left into some kind of popular front, if you will, against the surveillance state or whatever you want to call it. I just want to know where he's coming from. With Assange, I mean, the Assange story is bizarre. But there it seems to me that, you know, the fact that he is has a TV show on Putin's network and so forth, what it suggests to me is that he's much more tight with the Russians than anyone has yet found out.
You wrote that the value of some of their revelations does not mean that they deserve the prestige and influence that has been accorded them. And then you go on to say the records they leave suggest they really aren't interested in reforming our intelligence operations. They really don't think there should be any intelligence operations.
Well, it's hard to see what kind of intelligence they would be able to accept, especially if they're going to be saying that what the NSA has done is an attempt by the U.S. government to know everything that you have ever done in your life. It just doesn't make sense. That's the paranoia that I'm talking about. I think it's a way in which people think that this dark surveillance state is capable of any wrongdoing and will only be engaged in wrongdoing.
It's an interesting story, and from a historical point of view, it's an important story. But in terms of the immediate consequence, does it really matter who these people are or what they believe if the information they provide helps us examine and improve our democracy?
Of course it matters. That is not to say that the revelations that have proven to be true are not useful. So for that, we can congratulate them. But that's not all that matters, because we've had a tremendous breach of national security here. So what are we to make of that?
You told our producer, Sarah, that the distinction between motive and outcome is a false distinction.
Mm-hmm. Yes, because I think that you can't understand a story of an event happening without understanding motives and outcome. You can't separate one from the other. That's not to say that finding out about motives should in any way diminish the importance of those revelations. Not one bit. But I think to say, look there, look there, look there, don't look there, don't look there, only look there, is not the way that we go about being an enlightened democracy.
Okay. Sean, thank you very much.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Sean Wilentz is an American history professor at Princeton University and contributing editor at The New Republic. His latest cover story for the magazine is titled, "Would You Feel Differently About Snowden, Greenwald, and Assange If You Knew What They Really Thought?"
Coming up, under what circumstances can you say the word Nazi or mention a person's past or current gender? Who decides?
This is On the Media. This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Last week, ESPN's sports website Grantland ran a remarkable story titled Dr. V's Magical Putter, a journalistic odyssey that began with curiosity about a supposedly revolutionary golf club and ended by focusing on the chaotic life of its inventor, a woman named S.A. Ann Vanderbilt. Reporter Caleb Hannon was first bemused by the eccentric inventor, whose MIT and Wharton pedigree, she said, landed her a top-secret job developing stealth technology for the Pentagon. Her golf innovations drew heavily on her expertise on inertia, momentum, and other forces of physics. But in time, Hannon discovered Dr. V was a liar, selling putters on the basis of an invented history. Not only was her resume fraudulent, he could find no record of her existence before the early aughts. When he discovered that S.A. Vanderbilt was born a man named Stephen Kroll, as Hannon described the moment, a chill ran down my spine. That turn of phrase, suggesting shock or perhaps even revulsion, was just one element of the story that incited rage in the transgender community and beyond. Because 3 months before the article was published, Dr. V, who had never wanted to be publicly identified as transgender, committed suicide. Hannon was accused by many of unethically outing her and by some of being culpable in her death. Another ESPN.com writer, Christina Carl, herself a transgender activist, responded to the Grantland piece on Grantland with an essay titled, "What Grantland Got Wrong, Understanding the Serious Errors in Dr. V's Magical Putter." Christina, welcome to On the Media.
Glad to be here, Bob.
The stakes are not low here. As you point out in your essay, the suicide rate in the trans community is stratospheric. When someone writes of chills going up his spine at the discovery of sexual transition, does that suggest some sort of freak show?
Let me stop you right there and also say that a more appropriate term would be gender transition, because sex and sexuality really don't have anything to do with it. The problem here, I think, is trans people already have to deal with the challenge of being othered because their experience is so different and alien from what people consider normal. His editors letting him refer to it in those terms really kind of contributed to the fact that this is somehow weird and something that needs to be sensationalized, and that's not something you should do.
Christina, this matter is not so simple. By the time Hannon unearthed Dr. V's gender history, he had long since uncovered a fraud. She was selling putters based on a series of lies. She'd taken money from investors. Hannon hadn't meant to do an investigative piece, but she took him down a rabbit hole. Is a con woman in mid-con entitled to journalistic privacy?
Absolutely, and this is one of the problems, this idea that, oh, she's misled us on these other things, so her gender needs to be bundled with those. And that was a mistake, because you shouldn't put those together. Whether she's on the up and up or not, she still deserves that basic courtesy, that basic respect. If you come across something, you don't out them. That's not your responsibility. If anything, you talk to the person, you can tell them that I found this out and I am not going to out you, provide reassurance on this score. That would have been common courtesy from my perspective and was something that he could have done but did not.
I'm wondering when gender identity can be germane to a story such as this. For example, if I had been reading about this case and the huckster in question just had a total blank history before 2003, and that was brought up by the reporter, and the reporter found the explanation for that, and that was a change in gender identity and a new name and so forth, isn't that information I kind of need to have as a reporter? And if there's no mention of chills and weirdness, as Caleb Hannon used, is that not germane?
If it's a story about a golf club, and it's a story about her ability to design and create this golf club, if her credentials are the key element here, you know, all of that stuff revolves around, is she who she says she is in terms of a working professional delivering this putter? That's the only context in which this matters. If you want to talk about the golf club story, then execute that. Don't talk about the gender whatsoever. But if you're going to go there, then you're not talking about a sports story anymore. You're talking about transgender people and the problem of suicide. And that's a story worth talking. Grantland may not be the right place to have it. Again, how people talk about trans people and suicide isn't necessarily something that hits the mainstream media ever in the first place.
Dr. V lived, as they say, in deep stealth. But by putting herself forward in such a public way, she was dishonest and got caught and therefore exposed herself to scrutiny. The word self-destructive comes to mind.
Whether you transition or not, you don't get the right to then, you know, make up a past that you clearly don't have. I can't sit there and make a claim that I was a particle physicist or won like the Nobel Prize. Nobody gets a free pass there. I mean, I don't know why she made all of that up except to sell a golf club.
This story did not happen in isolation. I gather you frequently find yourself wincing at coverage involving transgender people. This is Katie Couric and transgender model Carmen Carrera.
Your private parts are different now, aren't they?
I don't want to talk about it because it's really personal.
Do you see a lot of that kind of morbid, gaping fascination?
Basic monkey curiosity is native to the species of human beings. You know, you don't get to ask somebody about the state of their genitalia. I wouldn't ask that question of anybody else, so why would I even go there with this person? If you use a little bit of common sense, you're not going to get yourself in trouble here. But you have to allow that a lot of people just don't know many trans people, unlike the gay and lesbian communities, where a lot of people can say, like, oh, well, I have a cousin, or I have somebody in my office, or something like that, and then they can find it relatable because it's like, well, that's just my coworker, and so what's the big deal? Well, there are not as many trans people out there in the first place because we are such a small segment of society. And again, the way in which the media does play a role in terms of sensationalizing it, it does create this set of phony expectations about what kind of people we are.
We're speaking on Thursday. I have spent the last 5.5 days completely absorbed in the Dr. V story, in the original, in the apologies, in your essay, in hundreds of tweets on the subject. I have done all sorts of preparation to speak to you and the larger issue. And when I originally greeted you, I called you he. I heard your voice and a switch was thrown in my brain, and it makes me wonder, are you fighting an uphill battle here?
I admit, my voice is one of my tells. but then I'm openly trans, and I don't mind that people know my past, in part because I was already a public figure before I transitioned. It wasn't like I was going to be able to hide the fact that I was transitioned. But each one of us who is trans has to essentially navigate his or her own levels of comfort with themselves and how much they have a control over and what can they do about it. We each have our own solutions for the challenges we confront. But that said, considering where we are today, even in the light of this tragedy, even in the light of so many of the frustrations that we see, whether it's other public figures getting outed or, you know, that Couric interview and, like, you know, confronting the issue of what do you talk about with trans people, uphill battle or no, we are making so much progress. I think we've come so far.
Christina, thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Bob.
Christina Carl is a writer and editor covering Major League Baseball for ESPN.com and a board member of GLAAD.
On Wednesday, February 28, 2007, in an act of historic irrelevance, the New York City Council voted unanimously to ban the N-word. There would be no penalties for breaking the ban. It was a symbolic act. Symbolically silly, according to The Daily Show.
Leroy, are you at all concerned that we are banning one of the most versatile words in the English language? It can be used as a noun.
Yo, what's up, man?
A verb.
Hey, man, don't those potato chips.
An adjective.
Oh, so now you rich.
An adverb.
Man, that's some niggly.
Are we kissing goodbye to all of this?
On January 15th, 2014, the Israeli Knesset gave preliminary approval to a bill that would criminalize the use of another N-word, Nazism, and its symbols, in anything other than an educational or certain artistic settings. Violators could draw a fine as high as $29,000 and up to 6 months in jail. The bill still has to pass three more readings and committee discussions before becoming law, and a similar effort in 2012 failed at the committee stage. But the bill's sponsor said he seeks to prevent disrespect of the Holocaust, the kind that results when Nazis are invoked casually, whether in political invective or adolescent insults. To most Americans, such a ban is shocking. The idea that the word Nazi shouted on the street could land you in jail, it makes no sense. Paja Faudry is a linguistic anthropologist and a professor at Brown University. Paja, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
So Roni Bar wrote in Haaretz that the committee backing the bill wants to preserve the trauma of the Holocaust. She doesn't agree with that, but she says they worry about the loss of meaning. Is that in fact what we're seeing?
I think that one of the things that's really interesting about this proposal is that it's not attempting to ban this particular set of words or symbols outright. It wants to stipulate the way they should be used. They want to preserve this really close relationship between particular symbols and words and this particular historical event, which of course has a very particular space in Jewish history.
Is it that they're afraid that the horror of those things will be diluted and that that in itself, given that this is a political body, might have political consequences?
I think that that is one possible interpretation, particularly to the extent that they see this as a pattern of speech that's prevalent among young people, people who are more distant now from the Holocaust as Holocaust survivors increasingly pass on, that the attachment to the Holocaust and to this narrative of the past is part of what makes the Jewish state hold together in spite of its many differences.
It's interesting that you talked about generations because Roni Bar, that young woman writing in Haaretz, likened those ministers supporting the ban to the wizards in Harry Potter who are unwilling to utter the name of Voldemort. She said that her generation has their own meaning for Nazi. She has her own. It's not the meaning her grandmother has, and she wouldn't invoke it to upset people of the older generation, but she doesn't plan to give up her meaning of the word Nazi. And she's clearly talking about the evolution of a word.
That's what language tends to do. It tends to evolve and change as it gets passed from one speaker to another, from one generation of speakers to another. And these kinds of top-down legislated attempts to enforce a kind of freezing of language tend not to be very successful.
What I think is particularly interesting is that in a way, Roni Barr is battling this issue out on the same field as the ministers who support the ban. They want it there because they want those words to remain powerful. But Roni Barr wrote that Hebrew speakers have gained courage. They have chosen to remove the stinger from the word, to disarm the killer of his weapon, to take control. We haven't cheapened the term. We've defeated it.
What is for some people a cheapening of the language is for other people a liberating move to be sort of freed of the pall that is cast by the past in which this word was created. And we have a long history of that happening with language. Terms like queer, for example, all kinds of words that used to be racial, sexist, whatever epithets that have been reappropriated have followed a similar trajectory where the initial charge of discrimination, of being pejorative, has abated.
As you said, language is always evolving, but what fuels that evolution? Who endows words with power?
Ultimately, it's always the speakers of the language. Sometimes there are speakers of the language who have more power than others. The editor-in-chief of the Oxford English Dictionary has more power over certain aspects of the language than does your average speaker, but it is ultimately always subject to the micro-decisions that speakers make every day that tend towards dynamism.
And yet, Paja, there are entire industries devoted to manipulating language, especially in the realms of commerce and politics, finger-licking good, pro-choice, pro-life. We're awash in signifiers. So you can do it from the top down and not just from the bottom up.
But I would say even in the cases where top-down attempts have certain kinds of success, their success is still partial because they never have total control. We have lots of cases of whole languages, for example, being subject to bans and to attempts to eliminate them entirely or to eliminate them from public contexts. And it doesn't wind up preventing those languages from continuing to exist. It just drives them underground.
So what do you think would happen if this passed? Would anything change? I mean, there's a sense that banning the word could ironically spark all sorts of subsequent discussions in which the word itself would have to be used.
I also think it's very likely that there will be overt attempts to resist the law, either by doing things that kind of test the boundaries around the circumscribed spaces that this law sets aside, namely educational purposes and some artistic purposes. If they use this word satirically or ironically, you know, what are the limits around those categories? What are the spaces where it's possible to use these words or symbols and get a pass? It just opens up a whole other set of questions about how to enforce it, how to police it.
You know, I was thinking what it would be like if they banned the word Nazi here. And it would be awful because it's such a wonderful indication that a person has a bad argument or is losing the debate. The New Republic called it reductio ad Hitlerum.
That's wonderful.
Paja, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Paja Fodry is a linguistic anthropologist and professor at Brown University.
Coming up, the world's worst poster child for free speech on the internet.
This is On the Media.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. This week, the Supreme Court considers a case involving the viewing of child pornography online that could have an impact far beyond the case at hand. In 2008, a lawyer named James Marsh became a pioneer in child pornography law by accident. He'd been hired by the parents of a teenage girl who the courts call Amy. Amy's uncle raped her when she was 8 or 9, took pictures of it, and distributed them online. He went to jail, but his pictures became among the most widely viewed child porn in the world. Marsh was looking for a way to get Amy restitution, compensation for the damage done to her by the distribution of her picture. Finally, he stumbled on a 14-year-old law he thought might hold the key to Amy's payback. Karen Duffin reports.
It was the Violence Against Women Act. Passed in 1994, this act was the first law to comprehensively address domestic abuse and sexual violence against women. James Marsh.
Statute says the victims are entitled to the full amount of their losses, and it's a mandatory statute. To me, it seemed like a very simple answer to a complicated problem of somebody whose assets were otherwise unrecoverable.
So he sent a restitution request to the U.S. attorney on Amy's behalf. Marsh just assumed this was standard practice.
We soon found out that it was the first request for restitution by a victim of child pornography possession in the country.
The 1994 law was born in the internet's infancy. It didn't anticipate a time when internet child pornography would become a multi-billion dollar industry. So applying this law to child porn,
this was something that was new, that nobody felt comfortable dealing with.
The courts are much better versed at dealing punishments for perpetrators than doling out restitution for victims. Marsh's seemingly simple answer turned out to be so complicated that eight district courts haven't been able to sort it out. So this week, the Supreme Court is stepping in. Why was the matter so complicated? Seven words found in the Violence Against Women Act. The act listed the categories of loss that may be compensated, things like medical services or lost income, attorney's fees. The last category was, quote, any other losses suffered by the victim as a proximate result of the offense. Those seven words, as a proximate result of the offense, require that a straight line be drawn from the perpetrator's action to the victim's loss. But how do you draw a straight line on the tangled web of the internet? The perpetrator in Amy's case, Doyle Paroline, did plead guilty to possessing her pictures. But his lawyer, Buck Files, says Amy can't draw that direct line.
There is a difference between harm and loss. A person can be harmed, but unless they can quantify some conduct on the part of an individual defendant and show that that conduct resulted in a loss to them, then restitution is simply not appropriate. The record clearly reflects that there is nothing to show conduct on his part that results in a loss to Amy.
But a group of senators who helped draft the 1994 law say that you don't have to show a direct line for any category of loss that's listed in the act. Victims are automatically entitled to compensation for medical costs, lost income, and so on. Victims have to prove that the perpetrator directly caused their loss only if that loss is not specifically listed. But on the internet, thousands committed the one crime of viewing Amy's pictures. If every viewer owes Amy restitution, how much does each one owe? James Marsh.
The challenge in this case really is, how do you assign a value to any particular defendant? And that is really what has troubled most of the judges and commentators out there.
She can't just divide her losses by the number of viewers. It's impossible to calculate. So she has to file suit after suit. Marsh has filed over 700 restitution requests on her behalf. That's what these victims do. They go from state to state, court to court, saying,
please give me my restitution. Please give me my restitution. Please give me my restitution.
Meg Garvin runs the Crime Victim Law Center.
Amy, who was raped as a child, now everyone's looking at her image, will have to go across the country, court by court, and say, please, please, I need money for my counseling. And that could go on for 20 years.
Amy has calculated her total lifetime loss at $3.4 million for things like lawyers and therapy. So far, she's recovered $1.7 million from 182 defendants, some with checks for less than $20. The largest was $1.2 million from one wealthy defendant. This process takes a lot of time and a lot of money, and she says it perpetuates her pain. So her lawyer, James Marsh, started looking for an easier solution, and he found it in a legal theory called, quote, joint and several liability. It says that when many people jointly commit a crime, you can sue just one of them for all of your losses. And that one person
is allowed then to go after all of the other defendants who are committing this same crime and even out the losses.
So it shifts the burden of collecting restitution from the victim to the perpetrator. It's used primarily in civil cases. Marsh is the first to apply it to child pornography.
This is a very standard notion in federal law. It just hasn't been employed in this way to these kinds of individual crimes.
Using joint and several, Marsh identified one person who'd pled guilty to possessing Amy's pictures, the defendant in the Supreme Court case, Doyle Paroline. Amy is suing him for the full $3.4 million, and then Paroline has to chase down the others if he wants help paying for their aggregate sin.
It boggles the mind that an award of $3.4 million could be entered for an individual who had in his possession two pictures of Amy, one of which was not even identifiable without computer reconstruction.
Paroline's lawyer, Buck Files, says that such excessive fines are outlawed by the Eighth Amendment. Not so, says Marsh, because they can be shared by the broader pool of defendants, and they're allowed to pay in installments. Seven district courts sided with Paroline, but one district, the Fifth, accepted joint and several liability and awarded Amy full restitution. So now it's up to the Supreme Court to answer the underlying question. Who should be responsible for chasing down a victim's losses? The victim or a perpetrator? Meg Garvin again.
In the equities analysis, which one is fair? Well, Amy's the victim. She committed no crime. She shouldn't have to do the work. We shouldn't re-victimize her in the process. So I think the equities very clearly fall in Amy's favor.
Jonathan Turley, a law professor at George Washington University, says that if Amy wins, it will fundamentally affect the concept of proximate cause.
That may seem arcane to most people, but that concept is what limits the legal system to prevent the abuse of those accused of crimes. So this goes far beyond child pornography. It will have ramifications across the fields of torts and constitutional law, as well as criminal law. This is as fundamental a challenge to this principle as we have seen in this country.
So to recap, the High Court not only has to reckon with a rare case of restitution in a criminal case, charged to a viewer of child porn, on the legally murky terrain of the internet, no less, it also has to decide whether to leave that viewer, one among tens of thousands, with the whole bill. And before all that, reconsider whether the victim does in fact have to prove proximate cause, defined as, quote, an act from which an injury results and without which the injury would not have occurred. Amy's life was derailed by a monstrous uncle, and then by a legal system slammed by the unforeseen impact of the internet. But relieving her distress may cause a ripple of unintended consequences. What if other information is, say, stolen, posted online, and then downloaded by some random third person? Would that person be liable for all the potential harm caused by viewing? Should that person be bankrupted because of a curious click? It's a good day not to be a judge. For On the Media, this is Karen Duffin.
On last week's show, I spoke with Ellen Angelotti of the Poynter Institute about the first Twible case in the United States and what it means for our understanding of defamation online. Ellen is back for round two this week after a federal court ruled that a blogger who had lost a defamation suit in 2011 should have the same free speech protections as a traditional journalist and as anyone else who publishes online. The decision from the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals is being hailed as legal proof positive that journalism is not defined by the medium it appears in, but by the acts of reporting and opinionating themselves. The blogger in this case is Crystal Cox, whom we've discussed on this show before. Her blog and other online activities have elements of journalism, elements of gadfly crackpotitude, and elements of a shakedown racket. And she is a very persistent adversary. Ellen Angelotti is lawyer and member of the Poynter Institute's faculty. Gosh, Ellen, you again?
Thanks for having me back.
Before we get into the details of the most recent Cox decision, describe the original case, which Crystal Cox lost to the tune of a $2.5 million jury award.
So Crystal Cox had created a website called bankruptcycorruption.com and accused Kevin Padrick, who was a trustee for a company that he was a thug, a thief, and a liar because of his actions as a trustee in a bankruptcy case. There were many blog posts, but there was one in particular where she interlaced a lot of her very strong opinions with facts based on anonymous sources.
And in defending herself, she claimed she did not have to identify her supposedly anonymous sources because she was entitled as a journalist to protect their identities, to keep them anonymous. And the court said, no.
Yeah, Crystal Cox claimed that she was protected by Oregon's Shield Law, and therefore she was able to protect her anonymous sources. And that was one of the contexts that the court ruled that she did not work for a traditional media organization, and they actually laid out seven factors that determined whether or not she was an actual journalist.
And now the Ninth Circuit says the court was incorrect, and it's arbitrary to assign kind of legacy standards to online journalism. It's great that a higher court has finally acknowledged that journalism isn't defined by where the journalism appears. But is this ruling an invitation for anyone to go online with vile, unsupported allegations against any poor schnook they don't like?
That's where the tension is with this case. When you have a defendant here like Crystal Cox, it can be a little troubling to promote her behavior. And that is why one interesting part of this case is the blog post in question from December 25th, 2010 will still be analyzed under defamation. So she can still be liable for making these allegedly false statements about somebody whose reputation was harmed by her statements.
Now, this decision from the Ninth Circuit, I guess, can help guide other courts, but it's not a precedent that is necessarily going to be applied nationwide, is it?
No. So for a case to apply to everybody, it would need to be decided by the Supreme Court. There are a handful of circuits that have also eliminated the distinction between traditional media defendants and have stated that the First Amendment applies to everybody. But this is not a uniform decision that applies to everybody in the United States.
Now, listen, before you go, there's one more thing I have to discuss with you. As I mentioned earlier, last week we discussed what you called TWiBL, which is libel via Twitter, the so-called TWiBL case involving the actress and singer Courtney Love, who had in a tweet accused the lawyer of her late husband's estate of having been bribed. And that just caused us no end of grief because we were bombarded with tweets saying that there is no difference between libeling somebody on Twitter and any other medium, and that the neologism is fatuous and we should be ashamed of ourselves. I blame you, but should we be ashamed of ourselves?
I even responded to some of these comments because this is not a word that I invented. This is a word that has been used in many conversations about defamation in the context of Twitter. Now that everybody has a platform to publish on, is litigation really the best remedy, or do we need to come up with some other recourse that help people to repair their reputation or minimize the harm that false and defamatory statements can cause them?
All right, Ellen. I suppose we'll be talking again this time next week. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Ellen Angelotti is a lawyer and a member of the faculty of the Poynter Institute. Crystal Cox's online acting out doesn't stop at persistent blog posts or with the victims in this case. She's also gone to some trouble through search engine optimization and hundreds of websites to tar the reputations of her many targets, people like New York Times columnist David Carr and First Amendment lawyer Mark Randazza. We spoke to Randazza in the spring of 2012 about Cox's online reputation racket. Cox had asked Randazza to represent her in court pro bono. After a kerfuffle, he ended up not representing her, and she retaliated by registering such domain names as markrandazza.com, markrandazzasucks.com, markrandazzaisalyingahole.com, and others. She then offered, through her reputation management services, to take those websites down for a price.
It would be akin to you doing a hit piece on me and then saying, well, I can be a journalist today, but I can be your public relations agent tomorrow. And if I do that, well, we can clean up all this mess that I made. And I told her I thought that that was unethical and uncalled for, and asked her to give the domain name to me. And she refused and went off on a tear.
Tell me about the tear.
I could go through it and find portions of it that were defamatory. Much of it was opinion, and it was negative opinion, but it's, you know, she thought I was pompous and arrogant, and, well, I mean, that's a requirement to be a member of the bar, I think. I always preach this mantra that the cure for bad speech is more speech. Then she started to target my wife. My wife is just a wonderful person. I mean, she is, in her wedding vows to me, she wrote that she would stand like Anita Garibaldi next to me in all my crazy fights. And, you know, God actually chokes me up to even repeat that. He said, I got to tell you something. You've been now dragged into one of my battles. I was stunned at how much it just rolled off her back. She said, I don't really care. So when that didn't have the desired response, then Ms. Cox went after Natalia, who is my 3-year-old daughter. While I considered legal action at that point, I thought, this is the time where I have to tell the story. In telling the story, other people saw that story and said, enough's enough. I knew I had to stand up and say something because the next person is not going to be a First Amendment attorney. The next person might be somebody particularly vulnerable. The next person might actually pay her requested $2,500 a month in quote-unquote reputation service management.
At any point in this siege, did it ever occur to you to call the FBI?
That discussion came up. But I wanted the front line of this to be that the First Amendment works. Even an unsavory person like her has First Amendment rights, and I even still believe in her First Amendment rights. If we're going to believe in the First Amendment, we have to believe in it for the American Nazi Party wanting to march in Skokie, and we have to believe in it for, you know, somebody like her going absolutely crazy anytime somebody doesn't do her will. And if you can withstand that without involving federal authorities, I think you ought to.
Mark, when your 3-year-old was being dragged into your own personal First Amendment nightmare, at any point did you come to doubt the sanctity of free speech?
Fortunately, I thought about this before my daughter was born. I talked to a former partner of mine, Jessica Christensen, who has been a real good barometer for my beliefs. And when I need something like this, I talk to her. And I said, doing what I do has been one thing when it's only been me. When I represent these unpopular causes, when I'm standing up for the rights of adult entertainment companies, and I can weather that because this is what I've chosen to do. But now there's an innocent person coming into the world, and she's going to be at school, and the kids are going to learn how to use Google, and are they going to look at her and go, your father's a smut lawyer? And Jessica's advice has always resonated in me, and she said, you know, you have to take care of your family, but part of taking care of your family is showing moral leadership, and this is what you believe in, and this is what you want your family to believe in. When, you know, God forbid, I mean, you know, we all rebel against our parents, so who knows, maybe one day she'll be working for the Department of Justice on the obscenity task force, and I'll be saying, I have no daughter. And until then, I have to live with my daydream that one day she'll be sitting there as my law partner and we'll be fighting these cases together.
Mark, thank you very much.
It's my pleasure. Anytime.
Mark Randazza is a First Amendment lawyer who blogs at The Legal Satyricon. When we spoke to him back in April of 2012, he was pondering his options. In the end, he decided to take Cox to court, and yes, he won. He told us this week that his legal strategy had nothing to do with the content of Cox's speech. His arguments, he explained, were based on domain law, and those court arguments are available upon request for free should you ever find yourself in Cox's crosshairs. That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Alex Goldman, PJ Vogt, Sara Abdurrahman, Chris Neary, Laura Mayer, Mira Sharma, and Alana Casanova-Burgess. We had more help from Kimmy Regler, and our show was edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineers this week were Andrew Dunn and Rick Kwan.
Katya Rogers is our executive producer. Jim Schachter is WNYC's vice president for news. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.